Others will. I got a letter the other day. It was a humiliating letter from a gentleman I've never met in Louisiana. I haven't read the whole letter. It's too long. He had just read the Catholic Catechism. He said, "Father, why did you use such big words?" Here I am, and it's a very intelligently written letter. Here I am trying to understand my faith. Then he lists all the big words that I used. I was ashamed of myself. And I'm sure if I had the job of rewriting, you know what he said? He's willing to rewrite the catechism. So we have all kinds of functional evidences, not of sanctity, but of just the opposite. Agreed? Impatience. Laziness. I told the sisters this morning, I got on the plane yesterday at LaGuardia, after I witnessed that spectacle of mother and daughter. Then I got into my seat, 10F. E and D were next to me. This time it was a father and a son. The son was next to me, the father, in the aisle seat. The girl started making the announcements. He used to look at a card. He didn't have one. He saw that I had one. He took mine. Then, everybody was told you can read your Metroliner magazine. He didn't have one. He took mine. And I really wanted to take it. For just a split second, I thought to myself, if he were my kid, Mary sinlessness teaches us what makes us pleasing to God is His grace and not our heroic moral behavior. Mary, the holiest of creatures, if we can judge by the Gospels, lived a very ordinary life. But was she ever holy? Because God was with her. I'm reminded it's time. Is it? Okay. Shall we say the Angelus in the name of the Father? Oh, no, no. We say the Angelus. We will be treating of the supernatural life, and consequently, if you would take chapter 6 of the Catechism on the grace of God. So the grace of God, chapter 6 in the Catechism, is your written quiz for next time. Chapter 6 on the grace of God is your quiz for next time from the Catechism. The third of the mysteries we're looking at of Our Lady, the doctrine of Mary's divine maternity, as it is also called, states that Mary was truly not just the mother of Christ or the mother of Jesus or the mother of Christ's human nature, that she is the mother of God. What does it mean? What the Church intends by that doctrine is to make very clear that Christ is one person in whom the two natures, divine and human, are united. Mary didn't give birth to part of Christ or a piece of Christ. He doesn't come in pieces. There is one being, one individual, one substance, one person. The person to whom she gave birth is God. That settles it. Of course, obviously, Mary did not give Christ his divinity. Rather, her son gave her her humanity. So this is not mythology. Of course, Christ as God pre-existed his mother. But no less than our human mothers, though they do not, they as mothers are not the source of all that makes us. They are only the source of our human body. God must separately and distinctively create and infuse a human soul. Yet who would say in introducing your mother, "Meet the mother of my body"? What are you talking about? And technically, you'd be right. But really, you'd be wrong, because we just assume. The mother is that person who conceives and gives birth to the person. Whatever that person is, she's the mother of that. The child conceived and born of Mary was the Son of God. Very well, she's the mother of God. Behind the heresy, as we saw, of Nestorianism, which denied that, is dividing Christ and saying that there are two persons in Christ, one human, of which Mary was the mother, and the other divine, so that somehow the divinity dwelled in the human person. Not so. Every part of the child that Mary gave birth to was divine. The little finger on Christ's left hand was the little finger of God. No less, sustaining the analogy which the church uses, where is our soul? Wherever our body is the soul more in the head than the feet? No. It has a different function, fortunately, in the head than the feet. But it's the same soul. Soul has no parts, no pieces. So Christ's divinity assumed the whole of his human nature. Was there any part of Christ's human body that was not divine? Was there any part, humanly speaking, of Christ's soul, human soul, that was not divine? No. Every thought of Christ as a human being was the thought of God. Every tear that Christ shed as a human being was the tear of God. And we are even told by the church, when he died and shed his blood, that blood on the ground under the cross was hypostatically united with the divinity. It's our faith. Where is it taught? Of course, as you would expect, in the Council of Ephesus, which condemned Nestorius. The significance for us should be a great confidence in Mary's especially power of intercession, symbolized at Cana and shown ever since. Mary has influence with Christ that no one else has. In case you run out of wine or whatever you need, if she thinks it's worth telling Christ about it, and he thinks it's worth working a miracle, you'll get even the wine. Fourth mystery, perpetual virginity. The doctrine is very simply stated. As it goes in Latin, it's good to hear the phrase that Mary was virgo ante partum, in partu, and post partum. Ante partum, in partu, and post partum. Before giving birth, in giving birth and after giving birth. That's what the adjective perpetual means. She never had carnal intercourse before Christ was born. Unlike other human mothers, the physiological change that takes place in a woman in giving birth did not take place in Mary. She did not lose her virginal integrity in giving birth and after having given birth to Christ. She never had carnal intercourse for the rest of her days. Where is it taught? In all the creeds of Christendom. Conceived of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the word virgin occurs in all the creeds from the first century. There is a document which you can read for yourselves in the teaching of the Church, or the Church teaches, which you should have a copy of, Pope Siricius, Siricius, 392, one of the many, but also one of the earliest, formal documents of the Holy See testifying to Mary's perpetual virginity. It has never been formally defined as such, but occurs in so many definitions of the Church. For example, both in the Immaculate Conception, virginity repeated. Assumption definition, virginity repeated. What's the significance? On this, the saints and mystics have written, as we know, volumes. Why did God, when he chose to become man, decide to be conceived and born of a virgin? Evidently, because he so loves chastity. In other words, God wished to symbolize for all times He wished to symbolize for all times what he wants. He wants people in every state of life to be chaste, according to their respective state of life. Absolutely speaking, Christ might have been conceived by carnal intercourse. It is not absolutely impossible, of course, for God. Nevertheless, in order to both emphasize Christ having only a divine paternity, to emphasize Christ's divine eternity, to show that those who are conceived and born in sin are conceived and born in sin through paternal generation. Yes, the Father, who is the source of the sinful contagion with which the rest of us are conceived and born. Mary then conceived Christ virginally, and miraculously she gave him birth without any of the changes, as I said earlier, that take place in normal nativity, and we may be sure, having worked the miracle of conceiving Christ virginally, we can't imagine, though the Church teaches it and teaches it infallibly, she never had carnal intercourse after Christ's conception and birth. The Church also wants to bring out the fact that it is not only possible, but divinely fruitful in the only thing that really and ultimately counts, in procreating an offspring spiritually without having conceived carnally. Mary was a virgin. She was a mother, even as other mothers are physically, having conceived and given birth to Christ. But that virginity can be fruitful in spiritual offspring, and this especially in our own concern to live a life of chastity, to never for a moment suppose that those who have offspring naturally by carnal intercourse of their own are necessarily more fruitful in the spiritual benefits which they bring to mankind. Mary, though a virgin, is the mother of the souls that, thanks to the grace that her son gained for people, she, therefore, as a virgin, is supernaturally fruitful. And finally, as the Pope pointed out in defining Mary's assumption in 1950, though there are other doctrinal reasons for Mary's bodily assumption, one reason, so the Pope says, is because of her virginity. In other words, among the reasons why Mary, humanly speaking, merited a bodily assumption, and of course, soon after Christ's ascension into heaven, was her virginity. Fifth, cooperation, or being cooperatrix, in the redemption. We sometimes see that the expression co-redemptrix, which may be used provided it is properly understood. What does it state in the doctrine? That Mary cooperated with Christ in the redemption of the world. That, I think, is a better way of putting it than to say that Mary co-redeemed the world with Christ. Better to say that she cooperated with Christ in his redemption of the world. How did she cooperate? Hence the meaning. Mary cooperated by her free will in uniting herself with Christ's sufferings, passion, and death. She was, as the Fathers say, a martyr of affection, a martyr of sympathy, a martyr in spirit, or a martyr in will. Wherever is it taught? One of the longest developments of this doctrine is in the encyclical of Pius XII, Mystici Corporis, published in 1943. It also occurs in Chapter 8 of Lumen Gentium, which, as you know, is the chapter on the Blessed Virgin. What's the significance? It is here especially that Mary is our pattern for uniting ourselves with Christ in his sufferings, and as far as it is humanly possible, to say that we are cooperating in the redemption. Indeed, we can legitimately say we are cooperating in our own redemption. In fact, unless we cooperate, we won't be redeemed. How's that? We better. Now, how do we cooperate in the redemption, beginning with ourselves and then of other people? By joining ourselves, as we've just said, in spirit, even as Mary did. What does that mean? Whatever else was true of Christ's life and especially his passion and death, it was and involved suffering. There is no evidence that Mary ever suffered physically in a way comparable to the way that Christ did. In other words, she was never nailed to a cross. She was never scourged, never crowned with thorns. And because she had no fallen human nature, the church's tradition is she did not have the ordinary kind of ailments or diseases that we are subject to. But I hope you agree that the worst kind of suffering is not that kind in the body. Mary suffered mainly by her close intimacy with Christ. And consequently, when we ask ourselves how we are to imitate Mary in her role of cooperating in the redemption, it is through joining our sufferings with those of Christ. And here especially, these sufferings that we're talking about, in other words, Christ's suffering, a suffering Christ, as we distinguished earlier, we can and we should keep saying that Christ has two existences, one which is physical, the other which is mystical. The physical Christ can no longer suffer in his own person. The mystical Christ can, and in fact, he does. In other words, we can unite ourselves in will with the sufferings that Christ experienced physically when he was on earth in his mortal body. But right now, we can unite our physical sufferings as members of that body. In both cases, Mary is our model. The earthly mother of the church. I distinguish, you notice, between earthly mother and heavenly mother, then appropriately place the assumption in between to get Mary into heaven. She was then the earthly mother, and the church's doctrine, expressed especially in chapter 8 of Lumen Gentium, which is the constitution of the church. If anyone thinks, and there are those who have both thought and said, that the Second Vatican Council has somehow demoted Mary, or has placed less emphasis on devotion to Mary, they are dead wrong. The Second Vatican Council contains more in terms of the number of words, more in terms of the depth of doctrine, more in terms of development of new insights into Mary than any other council of the Catholic Church. And there were how many before the Second Vatican Council? How many? 20. It is especially chapter 8. In fact, do I give you reading besides, or do I just always assign something to be prepared for and then to be quizzed on? Is that the usual sequence? Do you mind if I add one little, just a little reading assignment for this course besides chapter 6? Read chapter 8 of Lumen Gentium. And just so we have a record of it, could I ask you, and would say, Sister or Pat, would you remind me to remind all of you, when you turn in your quiz next week, to just put down just put down the word yes, someplace on top, okay? And that'll mean yes, I read chapter 8. How's that? What's the meaning of Mary as the earthly mother of the church? When did the event take place? When did we, as we say, give birth as the mother of the church? Because a mother gives birth, right? The church was born on the cross. And as the fathers of the church explain, in a way comparable to how the first Adam came from the side of the first Eve, so the church was born of the open side of Christ, and it was Mary's willing cooperation, her total submission to the will of God when she saw her son die on the cross. She had to be there. The fact is assured us by the words of Christ to John, who represented as, we believe, all of us. Behold your mother. However, a mother not only conceives and gives birth, she also nourishes and cares. Or to use the verb, she mothers. She just had to stay around after Christ visibly left the earth and left the disciples looking up until the angels, remember, had to tell them, gentlemen, will you stop looking up? She was with the apostles, waiting for Pentecost. She received the Holy Spirit along with the apostles. We don't know how long she lived after Pentecost, but long enough, we may be sure, to have encouraged, inspired, consoled, and fortified. Not unremarkably, we have no record of Mary's ever teaching. And most significantly, as the document of the Holy See on the subject makes plain, and she never exercised the priesthood. But as I may have quoted this before, I like the expression that Mother Teresa told me when she spoke a couple of years ago at the International Women's Year in Mexico. And she knew, the moment I opened my mouth, I was in unfriendly company, because she spoke on becoming like Mary and not ambitioning the priesthood. Why, she said, this is Mother Teresa, would you want more than Mary had? She who could embrace the child in her arms and say, as no priest can, this is my body. The role of women in the church, and it's the church teaching us, is to mother the church. And believe me, if you have any doubts, the church today needs mothering. And among those who need the patience, the sympathy, the compassion, the self-sacrifice, are especially the church's leaders, the church needs women. The bodily assumption into heaven taught implicitly in the early church the first explicit reference to Mary's bodily assumption is about the 5th century. This then does not have that early revealed history that, say, even the Immaculate Conception has. It was defined, as we all know, in 1950 by Pope Pius XII. I'll never forget the day of the definition. I was laid up in the Jesuit infirmary, having spent the summer in Rome, one of the hottest summers in the history of Rome, working days and working nights. I was employed by the Vatican Radio, and among the things I did, ironically, was to give a series of conferences defending the forthcoming assumption against the attacks that by then were accumulating. But I didn't have the satisfaction of helping to broadcast the definition, which I would have done had I been in shape to do so. In any case, I listened to the radio as the Pope was defining the assumption. The meaning, of course, is very plain. Unlike the rest of us, who will all have a more or less long wait, that's the soul will have to wait, to be reunited with the body. There is no time between Mary's entering heaven in spirit and her entering there in body. Mary did not have to die. The church has never formally defined that she did die. Why not? Because death is the punishment for sin. And Mary, like Christ, did not have to die. This, by the way, is very good to know. Christ didn't have to die. Christ was not naturally mortal in the sense that his mortality was the built-in consequence of his having a fallen human nature. Mary, too, need not have died. Most likely she did. What certainly happened was that she, who gave birth to Christ in body, would be with him, body and spirit. What's the significance for us? I'd like to recommend all kinds of things for your reading. There was a beautiful homily, really a conference, that Pius XII gave to some 600 bishops on the day after the definition, to be exact, November the 2nd, 1950. The definition was on November the 1st. That homily is beautiful and very revealing. Here are some reasons that Pius XII gives for why he defined Mary's bodily assumption. First, in order to show how pleasing Mary is to God, that she is with her Son, not only in spirit, but also in body. Secondly, to encourage all of us who have to suffer and struggle in body, that we shall be rewarded, like Mary, not only in soul, but also in body. Thirdly, that this body, which today is being so pampered, ease, pleasure, all kinds of sinful indulgence in the body, is to be mastered and mortified. that we are to make of our bodies a sacrifice. And if we speak of our bodies as the temple of the Holy Spirit, very well. Well, that temple should have a sacrifice, and that sacrifice is our bodies. And the Pope, in this third reason, stressed the practice of chastity. And as we know, the practice of chastity in whatever state of life a person may be living in has never been easy. It is very difficult today. And finally, the Pope said, the Assumption was defined in order to teach especially women to respect their bodies and to use their bodies to help sanctify the human race. In other words, the body is sacred, and it is for this reason that it is not to be profaned, so that unchastity might be defined as profaning the temple of God. Eighth, Heavenly Mother of the Church. The doctrine is, as we know, that no less than a mother, is one who gives birth to, she is one who nourishes, care for, is concerned about. Mary has already given birth to the physical Christ, but she helps to give birth to members of the mystical body. But above all, she is the one whose concern and care for the Church, especially through her intercession, that we can go to our Heavenly Mother and be assured that she will be no less concerned or interested in our welfare now than she was during her earthly stay in first century Palestine. And finally, she is the mediatrix of all graces. What does that mean? It means that Mary, first of all, is mediatrix of all graces because she gave birth to Christ, who is the source of all grace. That's the first meaning of mediatrix of all graces. Secondly, she is the mediatrix of all graces because she cooperated with Christ, as we saw earlier. And therefore, as far as the word can be used, she is the co-mediatrix along with Christ. Always Christ is first. She below him, but also in a profound sense, along with him. And finally, Mary is the mediatrix of all graces because the Church encourages us to believe that whatever graces we need, she intercedes for from her Son. She is the mediatrix by intercession, as Christ is mediator by his passion and death. Does it mean then that we've got to be always conscious of the fact when we ask for grace that we're invoking Our Lady? Of course not. Does it mean that unless we ask, we don't get the grace? Of course not. She knows far better than we do what graces we need. What it means, in essence, is that if all the graces that we receive are made by God, so this is grace. That all the graces we receive come to us from Christ. The graces come to us through Mary. The importance of this, of course, is that we should not be scandalized at the amount of devotion which the Church over the centuries has shown towards Mary. And I suppose, like, for example, in teaching the missionaries of charity in the Bronx, by the way, what time do we stop? Please? 1 o'clock. Among the questions raised by one of the sisters in the Bronx last Thursday was, when we're talking about grace and the importance of invoking Christ and depending on His, well, mediation of grace. Well, one of the sisters put up her hand. She said, "Father, listening to you, I think we're doing wrong." And, of course, the superior was there. It seems to me most of our prayers are addressed to Mary. And it happens that the superior's name is Nirmala, which I understand is the Hindi for Immaculate, Immaculata. So I suppose she has a kind of a built-in prejudice in favor of Our Lady. And even, for example, in reciting the Rosary, as we do, the number of Hail Marys we've recited. Don't you think we've said more Hail Marys than Our Fathers? This calls for some explanation to defend our practice. In any case, have no fears. No matter how much we verbalize our devotion to Mary as addressed to her, and this is one reason for taking a course like this, that we realize that although she is the one through whose intercession the grace has come, they wouldn't exist except for God. They wouldn't be merited except for Christ. All right? It is therefore important not just pray to Mary, but pray to her wisely. So much for the principal mysteries. By the way, is that clock slow or fast? What time do you people have? I have 7 minutes to. Is that about it? Let's go by. That clock seems to be 5 minutes off. We don't quite finish. I hope we do. We can finish up next time. But what are the implications? 3, 7. First, Mary, symbol of the Church. This is especially in the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, where the symbolism which refers to the woman, remember, can refer either to Mary or to the Church. And in this sense, Mary as a symbol of the Church stands as the one who, you might say, typifies what the Church is supposed to be. Because, after all, she was the first member of the Church, and she is still, after her Son, the Church's greatest glory. What Mary is what the Church wants to be. Second, Mary is the pattern of sanctity. She is the ideal pattern for three reasons. First, because she is the holiest of creatures. Christ always, in his human nature, of course, was a creature, but Christ is God. Her sanctity is the highest. Secondly, her sanctity was modeled on Christ's. Though you almost want to think that Christ was modeled on hers, because after all, like mother, like child, we are sure Christ had her features. And the Holy Spirit must have made sure that Christ looked like Mary. Nobody could suspect that she was not his mother. But she was also the perfect imitator of Christ, because living so close to Christ, she reflected his virtues as no one before, and there couldn't have been a before or since, was Christ-like. And thirdly,